Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, a coup is underway in Zimbabwe, where Robert Mugabe, the longtime prime minister of that country, is being held under house arrest. What is going on? What does this mean for the continent? Our guests are Kumi Naidu. He is a human rights activist. He is the launch director of Africans Rising. And Dr. Gerald Horn, historian, Moores professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. Also, the latest on the GOP tax plan. Our guest is Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. And for this week's Earth Watch, we speak with Tetet Loron, climate justice program manager for IBON International. Tetet is in Bonn, Germany. She is there for COP23, UN climate talks. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. Congressional Republicans are speeding ahead with their efforts to pass tax bills in both the House and Senate. House Republicans expect to pass their version of the massive tax overhaul today. Donald Trump was expected to travel to Capitol Hill to rally House Republicans. In advance of final debate, Michigan Republican Tim Walberg promised the bill will benefit the middle class and more.
We developed a Tax Cuts and Jobs Act with those low and middle income families in mind. They need a break. This tax cut plan means bigger paychecks and more money in their pocket.
The plan delivers most of its benefits to corporations and the wealthy. It dramatically cuts corporate taxes, eliminates the estate tax, doubles the personal standard deduction, and repeals state and local tax deductions. Florida Democrat Val Demings.
The proposed tax bill is camouflaged as a tax break for the middle class, but you and I both know the only permanent tax breaks are for the richest people and corporations in America. Matter of fact, over 36 million families will see a tax increase.
House leaders were confident they have the votes to pass the tax overhaul. But the Senate plan hit a roadblock as Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin became the first Republican senator to say he opposes his party's version. Johnson complained the House and Senate bills are more generous to publicly traded corporations than to so-called pass-through entities whose owners pay taxes using individual and not corporate tax rates. Besides Johnson, Republican Senators Susan Collins of Maine, Jeff Flake of Arizona, and Bob Corker of Tennessee have yet to commit to backing the Senate plan. Pope Francis today rebuked those who deny the science behind global warming. He urged negotiators at climate talks in Germany to accelerate efforts to curb greenhouse gas emissions. Francis issued a message to the Bonn meeting working to implement the 2015 Paris Accord aimed at capping global emissions. Britain and Canada said they're launching a new alliance aimed at encouraging countries to phase out the use of coal. It is one of the biggest sources of greenhouse gas emissions. German Chancellor Angela Merkel disappointed environmental campaigners when her speech yesterday failed to set a deadline for ending Germany's heavy reliance on coal. Hilda Haney is president of the Marshall Islands, which are at risk of disappearing because of rising sea levels. She told the conference the islands are already experiencing bouts of extreme weather, alternating between drought and torrential rains.
Looking over the horizon, it is vital that every country responds to the call in the Paris Agreement to come forward with mid-century strategies before 2020. Loss and damage is real, and our citizens are paying for it.
The South African government has sent top officials to neighboring Zimbabwe to try to mediate the country's political crisis. The move follows an apparent coup in Zimbabwe. The Zimbabwean army has confined longtime leader Robert Mugabe to his home and seized control of the state broadcasting network. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai has called on the 93-year-old Mugabe to resign. Tsvangirai says Zimbabwe should undergo a negotiated, inclusive transitional mechanism and comprehensive reform before holding elections. Cambodia's Supreme Court has ordered the main opposition party to be dissolved and its leaders barred from politics for the next 5 years. The decision clears the way for the nation's authoritarian leader, Hun Sen, to remain in power for years to come. Hun Sen has been in office since 1985 and has held a tight grip on power since ousting a co-prime minister in a bloody coup in 1997. Three new allegations of decades-old misconduct by Senate Republican candidate Roy Moore of Alabama. He's already been accused by more than half a dozen women. Two of them say Moore sexually assaulted them when they were teenagers and he was an assistant district attorney in his 30s. In one of the new reports, a woman says Moore groped her during a 1991 meeting in his law office when she was a young mother in her 20s. Two other women told the Washington Post they were teenagers when Moore pursued them. His behavior included calling the school and having one teen pulled out of class so he could ask her out on a date. Others have reported Moore's aggressive behavior toward teenage girls at a local mall was so well known that security officials were told to keep their eye on him. President Donald Trump avoided shouted questions about whether Moore should withdraw from next month's special election. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said in answer to reporters' questions it would be helpful if Trump weighed in on Moore's actions.
He was on the no-fly list for a mall, which to me is pretty stunning. So it gives credibility to the allegations of these women.
Would you like to see the president weigh in and join your calls for one more?
Well, that'd be up to him, but, you know, he's the head of the party. Yeah, it'd probably be good if he'd say something.
I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
After declaring independence from the UK in 1965, a white minority government was established in what was then called Rhodesia. Opposing white minority rule in this African nation became a cause célèbre for anti-colonial and anti-racist activists around the world. A guerrilla war of national independence was fought in which Robert Mugabe, who then went on to become the head of the newly established Republic of Zimbabwe, participated and was a leader in. Robert Mugabe was seen as a hero in ending white minority rule, and that reputation has helped him to remain in power for 37 years until now. He became prime minister in 1980. His party is ZANU-PF. Robert Mugabe has long been criticized in the Western media, especially following a land redistribution plan he tried to establish, a plan he said the British had agreed to in ending their rule. Critics say, rather than land going to landless peasants, instead, Mugabe's party insiders got the best tracts of land and became wealthy. His administration is constantly attacked for corruption in the Western media, and it's been difficult for those of us not on the ground in Zimbabwe or on the continent to really know what is truly going on. After the death of his first wife, Robert Mugabe married his former secretary decades his junior age-wise. Grace Mugabe is said to be unpopular and is known for her rapid rise to power in the ZANU-PF party. She is also known for her extravagant lifestyle. The recent coup in Zimbabwe that has taken place just a couple of days ago is said to have been a result of the split in the party, with Grace Mugabe making moves to replace her husband as head of state. After Emmerson Mnangagwa, the man who was the longest-serving ally of Robert Mugabe, going back to the days of the war against white minority rule, he was fired as Mugabe's deputy. And Zimbabwe's military, who had long been loyal to Mugabe, put Mugabe and his family under house arrest. They say it is not a coup, but it certainly seems like a coup. Now, today, four countries are meeting to find a solution to the crisis. Mugabe is said to be refusing to step down, and President Zuma of South Africa, who heads the Southern African Development Community, or SEDAC, he is meeting with ministers from Angola, Zambia, Tanzania, and Botswana today. Here to discuss all of this, I would like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth one of our regulars here, Dr. Gerald Horn, who holds the Morse Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's published more than 30 books, including Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, and Paul Robeson, the Artist as Revolutionary. Dr. Horn, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'd also like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth, Kumi Nedu. Kumi is a South African human rights activist, renowned anti-apartheid campaigner. He currently serves as the launch director of Africans Rising and was formerly the international executive director of Greenpeace. Kumi, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so Kumi, let's start with you getting your take on the situation on the ground. I mean, there are a lot of mixed messages out there. The New York Times, in an editorial today, they have come out and said, well, a coup is not the answer in Zimbabwe, and that indeed it may just lead to the military basically being in charge and continuing some of the same practices of Robert Mugabe. So you have that on the one hand. On the other hand, there are reports that people from Zimbabwe are hopeful that there will be some change in their condition, a lot of whom are impoverished. And so, and the opposition in Zimbabwe, from what I understand, are splintered. And it remains to be seen what's going to happen and whether there will be some kind of unity government or if Robert Mugabe will be able to hold on. Kumi, your assessment.
Well, right now, I think what's triggered this is the sacking of longtime ally, some might say right-hand person to Robert Mugabe. His deputy, who was seen to be the putative successor, and clearly this was occasioned by his positioning his wife to actually succeed him, Grace Mugabe. I think this was seen as a step too far because Mnangagwa, the deputy, he has credibility within the veterans movement and so on. So I think from, you know, our perspective here, we, as Africans Rising, we are totally opposed to coups. And we think that, you know, it's unconstitutional and that, you know, whatever, however angry people might be against Mugabe, this is an unfortunate development. The positive thing is that so far it's been a bloodless coup, but it's still a coup, and that there are negotiations for him to kind of step down and leave sort of quote-unquote voluntarily. They've already saying that they've negotiated a safe passage for Grace Mugabe, a safe haven, unknown which that safe haven might be. And the best we can hope for, and this is what, given where things are now, a movement like Africans Rising will campaign for, is to ensure that there is a transitional government put in place, which I think is what the SADC leaders will negotiate, and to and for a fresh democratic election to be held on the fastest timescale. So it's an unfortunate situation, but I think in terms of given where we are, that's the best we can hope for right now.
Yeah, and Kumi, I'm wondering too, with Africans Rising and the younger generation of people coming up on the continent, we know that the continent itself is a very young continent. Now, some of the older people, of course, Mugabe is 93 years old. They remember the Mugabe standing up against the white man, standing up against minority rule, and attempting to redistribute land and that sort of thing. And, of course, that whole struggle was a cause célèbre. Bob Marley did a song on Zimbabwe. But since then, people are saying that Mugabe has been holding on to the laurels of his past, the fact of what he stood for at the time of the establishment of Zimbabwe, and the name was changed from Rhodesia, and has abused his power. So there's that on the one hand. And on the other hand, we know that the UK and Western powers have also been basically undermining Zimbabwe's economy and government, just as they did with the Nyerere's experiment with African socialism in Tanzania, and, you know, the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it has been really difficult for people not on the ground to really unpack what is really going on. So for a younger generation of activists on the continent, can you give us a sense of that view of Mugabe, even though I know that split is still there in terms of how people see him?
Well, you know, I should confess, I grew up as a young activist in the South African Liberation Movement, you know, singing Mugabe's name, revering him in the early years of, well, during the struggle and in the early years of democracy in Zimbabwe. And it's important to just remind ourselves that Julius Nyerere, when he was at the inauguration as the first time for Mugabe, he said, "Prime Minister Mugabe, you are inheriting the jewel of Africa. Please take good care of her." Because, you know, Zimbabwe was the food basket of Southern Africa. You know, the soil in Zimbabwe is one of the richest you'll find anywhere in the world in terms of agriculture, for example. And for young people right now, they are desperate. The economy has been imploding for a long time. Job opportunities are very scarce. Lots of people are having to survive in the informal economy. Many people have had to seek exile or, you know, jobs in Botswana, South Africa, and other neighboring countries. And so right now, I don't think there's any sense of affinity to Mugabe. But Mugabe has been, you know, the master strategist in terms of how he can manipulate situations and to survive. So I think right now, the part of what I think also gives emboldens the military is the sense that the economic realities of the majority of Zimbabweans as is so bad that they know that people generally will be on their side. So, you know, even we saw just a few hours ago the leader of the opposition, Tsvangirai, coming out and saying, you know, this is unconstitutional coup, but we're grateful that it's nonviolent, and we need now national unity and sort of implying a, you know, sort of a unity transitional government type of arrangement. But yeah, lots to play in the next 48 hours. It depends what happens at the SADC meeting. Sadly, the person having to lead that right now is President Zuma, who is implicated in massive corruption. Some of the extent of corruption on his part makes Mugabe look vaguely decent. So, you know, we've got a range of very complicated relationships that also date back to the liberation struggle. So I don't think anybody can predict with certainty right now what will happen in the next 24 hours.
Right. And Dr. Gerald Horn, bringing you into this discussion, you also spent some time in Zimbabwe. You have written about Zimbabwe. So put this in some historic context here, because I'll have to say on the question of corruption, no doubt there is corruption of governments, really, across the world. And I always remember the statement in the film, actually it was a film, Syriana, where the CIA guy basically said corruption, that's how we're going to get them. So we know that corruption is often also promoted and supported as a way of destabilizing governments and of undermining governments that may not fit exactly into U.S. and Western Europe's economic interests. But tell us your take on the historic context and what is happening now in Zimbabwe.
Well, you are correct about corruption. In this morning's USA Today, there's a front page story about U.S. Department of Justice attorneys defending Donald G. Trump's business interests, private business interests against outside lawsuits. I think that that corruption charge also has to be taken with a grain of salt because we know that Washington and Wall Street have a high degree of tolerance for corruption and also for political tyranny. I mean, look at neighboring Swaziland, which is an absolute monarch and hardly allows any political opposition. Look at Equatorial Guinea, an oil-rich country, which Rex Tillerson, when head of ExxonMobil, propped up as dictator, whose son, of course, has a plush estate in your neck of the woods, in Malibu, and has one of the largest collections of Michael Jackson memorabilia on planet Earth at the same time that people are starving. Look at Cameroon, for example, where Paul Biya has been in office perhaps as long as Mugabe. So we have to take that with a grain of salt. And we also have to realize that one of the reasons why Zimbabwe has been under such pressure, under sanctions by the United States and its North Atlantic allies, it's because of land reform. It's because Mugabe was perceived as reversing the fruits of settler colonialism, and the United States, being a settler colonial regime itself, is definitely and very much concerned about reversing the fruits of settler colonialism here. We know, for example, that indigenous land claims meet a fairer hearing in Canada than they do on this side of the border. So I think we have to be clear about what's at stake here and should not get it twisted. Another point that needs to be made is that these negotiations that are taking place raise issues that are of moment beyond Zimbabwe. What I mean is that the army has suggested, as you correctly noted, that it's not involved in a coup d'etat. What they're trying to frame this issue is as an inter-party dispute. They're trying to say that Robert Mugabe, as the head of the party, overstepped his bounds by purging other party cadre. However, the negotiations that are taking place right now with regard to Mr. Mugabe's future are not taking place at party headquarters. They're taking place at State House. They're not taking place at his residence either. And that, it seems to me, gives Mr. Mugabe a certain kind of advantage. And so I think we should stay tuned as to how this plot is going to unfold. This crisis in Zimbabwe also raises sticky issues about the relationship between the political party and the state. You see the same issue in China, for example, where there is some concern about the relationship of the People's Liberation Army to the ruling Communist Party and whether the army is basically a wing of the party as opposed to an auxiliary of the state. You have the same question in Zimbabwe. You have the same question in many different countries. I think that if we're going to dig ourselves out of this crisis, we're going to have to take with a grain of salt some of these crocodile tears that are now emerging from Washington and Wall Street.
Yeah, well, the thing is, Dr. Horn, I mean, the reality is, I mean, listening to Kumi's point about the deep economic crisis that people, the average person living in Zimbabwe, finds themselves in, and that hundreds of thousands of people have actually left the country, including fleeing to South Africa. So South Africa also has an issue with people fleeing across the border and all of the issues that might raise, as well as really trying to figure out a way to resolve this issue. So it does seem, I mean, Grace Mugabe has the reputation of being called, I think, Gucci Grace because of her extravagant lifestyle. Now, I'm sure that her extravagant lifestyle is nothing in comparison to the daughter or wife of Donald Trump, for example, but there does seem to be a double standard. So despite this double standard, it really begs the question that people on the ground in Zimbabwe are, you know, maybe hopeful that any change may be better than economically than the conditions they've been living under. Kumi, I know you both have to go in a few minutes, so I'd like you to respond to that as well. Yeah, Kumi, and then Dr. Horn.
So I think Dr. Horn's points, I agree with all of them in the sense that the complicity of the United States, Britain, and other Western powers is massive. Secondly, it's absolute double standards. They collude with even equally dictatorial regimes, some of which Dr. Horn quoted. The best thing they can do is butt out and stay quiet and zip it up, quite frankly, because whenever the UK government, for example, opens them out and makes some statement, all of that actually plays into Mugabe's hands anyway. That's what's happened. They have absolutely no credibility. They've violated the commitments that they made at the area of at the period of decolonization. And so right now, you know, Africans need to sort this problem out on our own. In fact, nothing that the West can say that will be helpful right now, because the credibility of the West in our continent is absolutely zero because of their double standards and self-serving policies and practices.
Right. And Dr. Horn, final thoughts from you.
Well, with regard to the gender question and the issue of Grace Mugabe, there's another gender question that I think needs ventilation. I'm speaking of the former Vice President, Joyce Mujuru, who was deposed a few years ago. And interestingly enough, the army, which now says that what led it to pull off this so-called coup was the deposing of Emmerson Mnangagwa, who was the deputy to Mr. Mugabe, was because of his Liberation War credentials. But Joyce Mujuru's Liberation War credentials were even more sterling than the deposed Emmerson Mnangagwa. And so you have to raise the question of why didn't her being deposed lead them to take some sort of action? I think that's the question that needs to be put to the head of the military.
Well, we're going to have to clearly come back to this discussion. I mean, going back to Kumi's point about the importance of Zimbabwe to the region and what the request that the late Julius Nyerere made of Mugabe, we're going to have to continue this discussion because you both have to go and we are out of time and there's a lot more to dig in this situation. So Kumi Naidoo and Dr. Gerald Horn, thank you both for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
All righty. We are going to take a short station break. And when we return, Dean Baker, the tax plan, the GOP tax plan is moving ahead in the House. Today, it looks as though there's going to be a vote today, but there's some discrepancy between the House plan and the plan on the Senate, and who are the winners and who are the losers in all of this. And also coming up, our Earth Watch from COP23, the UN conference on climate happening now in Bonn, Germany. We'll be right back. And the late, great Bob Marley, a song that is not well known, but a song that Bob Marley did entitled Zimbabwe, clearly at a time in the height of the movement against minority rule and now a coup in place in Zimbabwe. And we have to see how that's going to be resolved. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety, and you can subscribe for a free podcast. And I suggest you do that. Also, you can check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. www.sojournertruth.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And we would like to welcome our SoundCloud listeners. Yes, you can check us out on SoundCloud, where all of our back shows are also archived. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And today, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the African nation of Zimbabwe. We are now going to turn our attention stateside to what's going on in Capitol Hill that's going to impact each and every one of us. Now, Congress Republicans, they debuted tax bills in both the House and the Senate. Trump and the GOP, they're referring to it as plans for the middle class, despite them actually being a boon to corporations and the wealthy. Well, we'll see what Dean Baker, our guest, thinks about that. While the House is primed to pass its bill today, and it is said that House Republicans met with Trump just this morning, the Senate bill seems to have a rockier road. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell decided Tuesday to tie a partial repeal of Obamacare, yep, they're after repealing Obamacare yet again, to their plan. Basically, it would get rid of the Affordable Care Act individual mandate. Now, on Wednesday, Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin said he's against this tax legislation, making him the first Republican senator to publicly go against it. And Maine's Susan Collins and Alaska's Lisa Murkowski could again be swing votes against this bill, as they've consistently held strong against Senate attempts to repeal Obamacare and pass new health care laws. Before we introduce our guest, let us just go to a short clip from CNN about the tax plan debate.
A pitched battle has broken out between Democrats and Republicans over late-night changes to the Republican proposal.
Is there a summary anywhere? I mean, we got a 100-page document in a table, but surely somebody on the majority side has a list, an abbreviated list of every change that you made at 10:30 last night. What is making you do this to us?
At the heart of the fight, whether middle-class taxpayers will actually see relief in the bill. Republicans now relying on the repeal of Obamacare's individual mandate to finance just that. $338 billion to target things like an increase in the child tax credit and reduction in the plan's rates for middle-income taxpayers.
In short, the goal is to repeal an unpopular tax from an unworkable law in order to provide more tax relief to middle-class families.
But with it comes clear policy and political dangers for Republicans. The CBO says the repeal would lead to 13 million fewer people with health insurance over 10 years. Premiums, on average, would go up by 10% each year. And Democrats now seizing on another potentially damaging element. The plan sets every tax cut for individuals to expire at the end of 2025, meaning without congressional action, every single taxpayer, including those in the middle class, would see a tax increase. All as the corporate tax cut, slashed from 35 to 20%, remains permanent.
Taking money away from the middle class and working people's health care so they can do tax cuts for the rich.
GOP lawmakers, who say they are still on track to pass the bill by Christmas, have brushed off those attacks, saying a future Congress would never allow those increases to actually occur, and focusing instead on what sources in both chambers say has been the driving force behind the whole process thus far.
And here to break all of this down for us, I'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research based in Washington, D.C. He's frequently cited on economics reporting and major media outlets, including The New York Times, The Washington Post, CNN, CNBC, NPR, and others. He writes a weekly column for The Guardian Unlimited in the U.K. He also writes for other news outlets. And his analysis have appeared in other print journals, including Atlantic Monthly, The Washington Post, The London Financial Times, and more. And he is Dr. Dean Baker with a PhD in economics. Dean Baker, thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Okay, so Dean Baker, I mean, first of all, this thing being dubbed as the middle class tax cut, I mean, we've talked on this show a bit about living in kind of Orwellian times where, you know, one thing is said and actually the opposite is actually going on. Is this a middle class tax cut? And what are your thoughts then about the tax cuts that some individuals will get stopping in 2015, but the corporate tax cut embedded remaining indefinitely?
Yeah, it's 2025. Yeah, that's just symbolic of the hypocrisy in this bill. What they really care about, obviously, are the corporate tax cuts, the tax cuts for wealthy individuals. For example, getting rid of the estate tax, which literally only affects the very wealthiest people in the country. You have to have an estate of more than $10 million to have to worry about that. Most of us aren't in that situation. If this were about a middle-class tax cut, you wouldn't be having those end in 2025. There's very little for the middle class here. A lot of middle class people will pay more. You in California, many people in California, you have relatively high state and local income taxes. You also have high property taxes, mortgage interest deduction. Long and short, people there are likely to pay higher taxes because they're going to end the deduction for state and local taxes. That's not a middle class tax cut, certainly not for people in California. Same with hold in New York, and not coincidentally, these are blue states, states that have voted Democratic in presidential elections and congressional races. The big winners here, no doubt about it, these are wealthy people, and there are some nickels and dimes for more moderate income people. The answer on that really is it just depends. There's a child care tax credit. Currently it's $1,000. That goes up to $2,000, but it's not refundable, or not fully refundable, I should say. So if you have a single mother with two kids earning, say, $20,000, they'll get nothing from that. So the people who you might think need it most, you know, and this is a working person, so we're talking about someone who's working, you know, it's a $10 an hour full-time job, or, you know, maybe someone working a little less than full-time at 12, 13, 14 an hour, they'll get nothing from this. Very high-end people, it's often joked, this looks like it was written for Donald Trump. Because there's so many provisions in there, the estate tax that I already mentioned. It gets rid of the alternative minimum tax. That's a catch-all that says that, okay, if you're a rich person and you're able to find all these loopholes, you still have to pay 22% of your income in taxes. Gets rid of that. Donald Trump, in the one return that we have copies of, he paid the alternative minimum tax, would have paid much less otherwise. Lowers the tax rate on pass-through income. So if you're a high-end earner like Donald Trump, and otherwise would in principle be subject to the 39.6% tax rate, it lowers that to 25%. Very good deal for Donald Trump. Even includes special provisions. They reduce the deductibility of interest for corporations. That's actually a good thing. You can only deduct interest up to 30% of your capital. That's a good thing, but there's an exemption for real estate. Well, who has real estate? Donald Trump. The last one in there, that it's almost comical, there's this provision, I have no idea when it got in, there was already in law, that if you have a golf course and you put in that you turn over, say, to like Nature Conservatory, you'll never build on it, you get a deduction for that. They leave that in there, which, of course, Donald Trump happens to own golf courses. So it really is almost comical. Like if you sat down with Donald Trump and said, what could we do this? What can we put in here to make you better off? That looks like what they did. I'm inclined to think they didn't actually do that, but it does look that way.
Yeah, I mean, talk about taking people to the cleaners. By the way, polls are showing, the Quinnipiac poll just this past Wednesday, 61% of those polled think the plan will mainly help the wealthy. I mean, not that what people think or, you know, will have anything to do with what the Republicans, how they will move. But also, Dean Baker, what about this thing about going after Obamacare again? I mean, you know, it is true that a lot of people really didn't like the individual mandate in the Affordable Care Act. But the reality is, without the individual mandate, then what's going to happen?
This is the basic problem of health insurance markets, that if you're relatively healthy, you might well say, I don't need health insurance because
many people fortunate, they're in good health, and they don't need a doctor most of the time. So they might say, yeah, I'm not going to do that. Well, if you don't have those people in the pool, then the people in the pool are, by definition, less healthy, which means they have higher expenses. And obviously, insurance companies are in there to make a profit, so they're going to raise their premiums. And what that means is, well, maybe you're someone who, not totally healthy, but a little, you know, generally good health, you're looking at a high premium, go, well, maybe I'll take my risk. And you end up with a less and less healthy insurance market, which means higher and higher premiums. So the people who are most in need of insurance are suddenly looking at extremely high premiums that they almost certainly aren't going to be able to afford. Everyone who's familiar with healthcare, you know, the policy debates, I'm not saying the person you grab on the street, although they at this point might understand, be familiar with that as well. But all these people in Washington understand that. This is an incredibly cynical move that's designed to destroy the insurance market because they think it's funny. They think it's funny that people won't be able to get insurance, and then they're going to say, oh, it was all Barack Obama, and hope they'll get away with it. And who knows? On Fox News, they will. But, you know, that's obviously what they're thinking here, and it's an incredibly cynical move that's really quite explicitly intended to destroy the individual insurance market.
Yeah, and 13 million people less will get health care, according to the Congressional Budget Office. And two quick things, too. You know, on this corporate tax story, I mean, they sell this corporate tax thing as though, well, you know, businesses and around the world, you know, are hesitant to do business with the United States because we have this quote unquote high corporate tax. Now, from everything I've read or even people that I've talked to in the business world, this is baloney. I mean, you know, country, you know, people don't make a decision on whether or not they're going to be doing business with the U.S. based on that. But it's absolute, you know, baloney. But yet they're using it again and again with this kind of trickle down thought. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a big joke. We've been this route before. There's very, very little relationship between the tax rate and investment, and any number of studies have shown that. So the idea that we're going to cut the tax rate, there'll be this big surge in investment. Also, again, very simple, basic point to point out. When they keep saying the United States has the highest taxes, corporate taxes in the world, that's totally misleading. We have a high tax rate. 35% is higher than most other countries. What do companies actually pay in taxes? They pay roughly 18%, which, again, if you compare it to Germany, France, we're in the middle of the pack, and, you know, depending on the year, we're maybe a little above the middle, a little below the middle. We don't have high corporate taxes in the U.S. Now, just about every economist I know would agree it doesn't make sense to have a 35% tax rate and only collect 18% in taxes. So if you could reduce the rate, reduce loopholes, and end up with similar or more revenue, in my view, but in any case, at least similar revenue, that would be a good thing. But they're not, and they don't even say themselves that they're talking about a tax change that will leave revenue more or less in place. They're talking about collecting a lot less in corporate income taxes, which, again, if we lose that and we aren't prepared to run a much larger deficit, that means it comes from somewhere else. It's going to come from Medicare. It's going to come. One of the things they do here, absolutely incredible, they're ending the tax deductibility of interest on student loans. And also, this is something many of those grad students listening, I used to be in this boat myself, if you get a tuition waiver, if you're working, I used to work as a teaching assistant when I was in grad school, I got a tuition waiver for that. That tuition waiver was equal to the size of my income. You will pay tax on that now. That's going to be a huge blow to people who aren't from rich families trying to get a graduate education, because that's a lot of money out of your pocket.
Yeah. And, you know, this is really about stealing from the poor to give to the rich. I mean, that's really, you know, what's going on here. And you're absolutely right that clearly, you know, revenue will be lessened and going into the pockets of the wealthy. And I saw an article recently where, again, the GOP are going after welfare. Remember that, you know, with welfare reform, it's already been dismantled, you know, under Democrats, under the Clinton administration, where that safety net is pretty much in shambles. And nevertheless, you have the GOP yet again raising the whole issue of welfare, which has been so racialized and used in such a racist way to help to pay basically for this giant corporate tax cut and loss of revenue. I mean, welfare, but also other social services. I also heard that school teachers, I remember when I was teaching first and second grade, the beginning of each year, I had to go out and buy materials for my students because they weren't there. And I'm hearing now that teachers aren't going to be able to claim that, Dean Baker.
Yeah, no, they're throwing out a lot of things like this, and it's really nickel and dime stuff. So one is, yeah, they're trying to find anything they can to get the revenue. But the other is they, as I say, you know, I was not being in jest when they're saying they think it's funny that the insurance market's going to collapse. Same sort of thing with, okay, so they're going to make it harder for your teacher. You're trying to help out your kids who obviously the school should be paying for it, the school district. This is what we pay taxes for. They should make sure that your kids have the supplies they need. So a teacher out of their own pocket takes it upon themselves to do it. They can't get a tax deduction for that. Meanwhile, for the wealthiest people, they're going to be running wild with all the games this thing sets up. I mentioned the issue about pass-through income. This should have everyone absolutely infuriated because the idea here is, okay, so I have my business and it only pays, I only pay, it's not the business, it's me. I only pay income a tax rate of 25% because I created this shell business that's giving me the money. On the other hand, if I'm working as a normal employee and I'm relatively high earner, you know, say I'm getting $250,000, $300,000, I'm going to be paying 39.6%. Now, why on earth should someone pay less money because they created a shell business? Doesn't make any sense, but you could be sure that the people with a lot of money are going to do that to take advantage of it and pay less in taxes. Also, another thing, we were talking about the corporate taxes. One of the things they do here in terms of an international tax code, they're eliminating the tax on foreign earnings of U.S. corporations. So insofar as Apple's setting up shop in Ireland or wherever else they have operations, they're not subject to taxes on the profits they have there. And what's really important is we don't know how much profits they had there, and they will lie because they have no reason not to, and the IRS isn't going to be able to catch them. So we're going to find that all of Apple's money was made in Ireland. They already do that, but they will have a much bigger incentive. Currently, the tax is deferred, so at some point they'll bring it back to the U.S. and we tax some of it. As it stands under this plan, they would say their profits were in Ireland and Apple doesn't have to pay any taxes to the U.S. government. Great deal for Apple, but pretty bad deal for the rest of us.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about all of this is it's just so outrageous. I mean, when you think that one, you know, things have gotten to the extreme of being outrageous, something else comes in. But what about what's happening now in the Senate? It looks as though the House will likely pass their bill today. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin is now saying he's against the legislation. People are waiting to see what Susan Collins, what Lisa Murkowski are going to do. Your thoughts, do you think that this Senate bill may be in some trouble, especially now that they've mixed it up with appeal of a key part of Obamacare?
It's definitely in trouble. You know, they're putting a huge amount of pressure on these people. Collins is under a huge amount of pressure. I don't take for granted that Johnson will stick, but I do appreciate that for now, at least he's saying no to it. Murkowski, this is something that should have people infuriated. They gave her, there's a huge giveaway here that really shouldn't be in there, not my moral feelings about it. I'm talking about the legalities. They're allowing drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. That's not supposed to be in a reconciliation bill. That's supposed to be something that you should only have items in there that are overwhelmingly budgetary in nature. There's some very minor budgetary implications to that. But that's the big giveaway for Murkowski because she's close to the oil interest in Alaska who wanted to drill in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. They've been looking to do that for decades, so this would finally give them that. That may be thrown out by the Senate parliamentarian. The parliamentarian has been reasonably straight in the past, and I'm saying this based on people who know the law. I'm not a lawyer here, but people who do know the law, people are lawyers. They say if they're acting honestly, there's no way they can't throw that out. If they throw that out, the big bone to Murkowski is gone, so she has little reason to support it, given that she in the past had opposed repealing Obamacare. So if she goes the other way, Johnson goes the other way, Collins really staked her reputation on saying she was going to defend Obamacare, and obviously she understands what this issue. She's not stupid. So you may well have the three votes there. You also have McCain, who, again, who knows, you know, obviously.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, he might enjoy putting in Trump's face, but you just don't know with that guy.
Right. So it in fact might be in some trouble. And of course, the GOP, they're banking so much on getting something done, you know, before the end of the year. But
it's also worth pointing out here that they're really rushing it. That was in the clip you had.
Yeah.
About how they're rushing it. And the point is they don't want people to understand what's at stake, because they know if people realize what was at stake, they'll be calling up their members of Congress or senators and screaming at them, and they're trying to rush this through before that could happen.
Yeah, and already the polls, I mean, the polls increasingly are showing that people, you know, are opposed to this, so they're not exactly, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid. So we'll have to see how this plays out. But just finally, before you run, I mean, a lot of people are really wondering that if we get, you know, something like the GOP tax plan through, but even some of the moves that the Trump administration is making in other areas, like how long is it going to take to undo some of this damage to people's lives? You know what I mean? It could be decades.
You know, if you get everything through here, it's a really horrible story. If you have a turnaround in 2018 in the elections, you could maybe stop further damage at that point. But at what point could you get a situation where you have a president in Congress who would reverse this legislation? Who knows? And again, people don't get time back. So, you know, taking the case I was talking about with people in college, that they won't be able to afford it. They don't get those years back, so they may never get a college education, have a worse career prospects throughout their life. So a lot of the damage is going to be irreversible.
Well, Dean Baker, we appreciate you joining us and helping us to understand what's going on, breaking this down for us. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're now going to go to our weekly Earth Minute.
China recently proposed to turn the Qinghai Tibet Plateau into the world's largest national park. Nearly 8 million people would be removed in the largest peacetime displacement in history. Those affected are Tibetan nomadic communities whose livelihoods, language, culture, and lifestyle are intimately connected to the land. The issue is not just the park, but the sovereignty of the Tibetan people versus the right of China to displace them and use their resources. Unfortunately, conservation strategies like this that involve forced displacements are nothing new. Conservation International and other big green groups are masters of this devastating human exclusion model of so-called environmental protection. Ironically, removal of communities that depend on these ecosystems means no one is left to protect them. Forests may be illegally logged, wildlife poached, resources stolen, and the people are forced into cities where they suffer poverty, loss of culture, and exploitation. You can help stop this racist model of conservation. During this season of giving, be mindful of who and what your donations are really supporting. For the Earth Minute and the Sojourner Truth Show, this is Ann Peterman from Global Justice Ecology Project.
All righty. And we want to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project, including for our weekly Earth Watch. Now, we did have some trouble trying to get through to Tete Laurent, who is in Bonn, Germany, where she is attending the COP23 UN climate talks. I think we have her now. Tete, are you there?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Tete, because of the difficulties we had getting through, we literally just have about 2.5 minutes. In those 2.5 minutes, give us your view of what's happening there in Bonn.
Well, we are now close to the end of this 23rd meeting of the government, supposedly to address climate change. Yesterday, we had a high-level segment where, you know, the presidents of several countries and ministers also took the stage to make their announcements and pledges for climate action.
Right. Okay. So from the point of view of climate justice activists, do you think that that conference in Bonn was useful at all? Or is it just the same old from governments to Tet?
Well, it's a mixed bag. There are some positive little signals that, you know, Indigenous people's platform has been established, and hopefully it will get the resources also to get the work going. So these are kind of like the small things that we are quite positive about. But in the main, it's still the same deep divide between, you know, developed countries and developing countries. Since the Paris Agreement was adopted and everyone was applauding it, and you would think that, you know, somehow governments would still have that political goodwill in them to keep the momentum going, but that's not what we're seeing here based on the discussion.
Right. Well, why are we not surprised? Tet, we are going to have to pick this up and get more and an in-depth report from you, because we are out of time as a result of the little technical difficulties we had there. But we appreciate you taking the time to join us, and we appreciate the Global Justice Ecology Project, our partners for our weekly Earth Watch. Tet, thank you for joining us. We are out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team, our intern, Sherelle Withers, also Stephanie Case, our assistant producer, and Kiana Williams, our engineer for today. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow for our weekly roundtable. You will not want to miss that. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.